Hello, and welcome to this On Genocide audio blog commentary. Today, I tackle the vexed question of whether Amnesty International are still the profoundly compassionate voice for good which inspired millions like me in past times, or have become a pack of mass-murdering sociopaths, or are merely the pandering toadies of a pack of mass-murdering sociopaths. I can reveal in advance that the answer is yes. Part 1. The Conyism of Amnesty International. I received a phone call the other day from a telemarketer working for Amnesty International. He informed me that he was calling to raise awareness about events in Syria. He cited an urgent need for international action under the United Nations Security Council. Part of my response was to ask why Amnesty International felt a need to raise awareness over Syria, which is hardly absent from mainstream news reporting, while not having done so with their own reports of atrocities and ethnic cleansing in post-Gaddafi Libya. In a formal sense, Amnesty International remains politically neutral. However, Amnesty International has an extremely problematic record. In October 1990, Amnesty gave crucial support to the fraudulent and now infamous claim that Iraqi personnel had murdered premature babies by removing them from incubators. They would later retract that support, but less than 3 weeks after the incubator lies, Amnesty released a report on atrocities carried out by Iraqis in Kuwait. The report contained unconfirmed as well as independently verified reports of atrocities. Atrocities were definitely taking place, but why dramatize the report with unconfirmed allegations? Amnesty's answer? To raise awareness. But the entire world was already watching. Saddam Hussein was the most vilified person on the planet, except among some Arabs. George Bush had labeled him as worse than Hitler. It was not as if there were no atrocities taking place elsewhere, such as Myanmar and Honduras, nor were they not occurring in other military occupations, such as those of Western Sahara, East Timor, Palestine, and West Papua. Amnesty produced this report as the US was trying to gain support for unleashing the greatest mass violence on the world since the invasion of Afghanistan by Soviet forces. Amnesty must have known that this was going to involve massive suffering. To be absolutely clear, bombs dropped by US warplanes, even smart bombs, do not build schools, they do not organize elections, and they do not emancipate women, except in giving them the equality of the grave. I mention this at this point because most news and entertainment media treatment of the subject would have you believe that they do these things. What bombs actually do is kill, maim, and destroy, bringing suffering and physical pain, fear, grief, and material loss. Knowing this, Amnesty International played a crucial role in unleashing the bombing campaign known as Desert Storm, and the repercussions of that action dwarf by far any good that Amnesty has done in this world since its inception. Part 2. What did Amnesty enable in Mesopotamia? It is worth understanding just how much the scale of suffering brought about with Amnesty's crucial support outweighs the suffering they prevent in their fight against political imprisonment, torture, and capital punishment. The numbers are simply beyond a level that Amnesty could realistically dream of helping. But these victims suffered too, and their suffering is equally tragic, equally unjustified, and equally obscene. Operations Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and Desert Sabre can now be seen as the inauguration of a 2-decade-long genocide which took hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives, probably in excess of 2 million. The US was never interested in any human rights, as their betrayal of anti-Ba'athist rebels revealed. Famously, General Norman Schwarzkopf gratuitously allowed the rather surprised Iraqi military to use helicopter gunships against the uprisings that President Bush had personally and explicitly encouraged to take up arms against the Iraqi regime. Also, while US forces had allowed Iraq's Republican Guard to withdraw almost intact from Kuwait on the so-called Highway of Death, they massacred hapless conscripts who, by some accounts, were in fact mutineers. In these accounts, by exiles who had fled Iraq after the Basra uprising was brutally crushed, those killed on Highway 80's Mudla Ridge were conscripts headed to join the anti-Saddam uprising which had grown out of the anti-war movement in and around Basra. There is some controversy over the numbers killed by US warplanes on the Mudla Ridge. Initial military eyewitnesses and journalists such as Peter Turnley described and documented a large scale of mortality, perhaps thousands. Later arriving journalists, most notably Michael Kelly, saw less evidence of mortality, but given the undenied disposal of bodies by US personnel, this is hardly surprising. The explanation given later was that vehicles were abandoned before being attacked. Photographs of the vehicles are widely available, although they are often from long after the event. It is clear that they were almost all attacked. Whether it is conceivable that most were abandoned at this point, or indeed whether it is conceivable that they were not abandoned at this point, I leave to the reader's judgment. Regardless of what exact portion of vehicles were occupied when attacked, hundreds or maybe thousands of human beings died. Violent death is always obscene, but the photographs and descriptions of the victims here seem sometimes beyond obscenity. Helpless, fleeing, posing no conceivable threat to Allied forces, many victims were burnt alive while trapped in their vehicles. Schwarzkopf said, quote, "This was a bunch of rapists, murderers, and thugs who had raped and pillaged downtown Kuwait City and were now trying to get out of the country before they were caught." End quote. It is exactly this sort of application of mass condemnation, in this case given substance and verisimilitude by Amnesty International itself, that often underlies massacres and other atrocities. But along with reports of a column of mutineers, there are also reports of Palestinian refugees and even Kuwaiti hostages, who are among those fleeing along Highway 80. In Desert Storm, the bombing campaign, conducted under a specious air power doctrine which, like shock and awe, invented a military significance for civilian infrastructure, the US had attacked all sorts of civilian targets, including power generation and water treatment and so forth. It is a war crime to attack such targets, of course, and it is difficult to see how the US could even claim some military advantage. It made absolutely no difference to the military outcome what civilians were killed and what civilian infrastructure was destroyed. The military contest was so uneven, the opposing forces so disparate, that even the killing of Iraqi military personnel was gratuitous as well as grotesque. What followed thereafter was the so-called sanctions regime, a cruel, slow form of genocide, inflicting the greatest suffering of all on children. As waterborne disease and malnutrition condemned tens of thousands of under-fives to avoidable deaths, ironically, it was Iraq's premature infants that were forced to share in incubators and were dying for lack of simple bottled oxygen. In another irony, Madeleine Albright, who felt that 500,000 dead infants was worth it as a price for Iraqi containment, would, in 2012, be the keynote speaker at an Amnesty International event. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Maybe, in 1990, Amnesty was doing nothing more than to report Iraqi atrocities in the same way as any other atrocities. but the context of impending war was unmistakable, and they helped bring about one of the greatest mass atrocities in the post-World War II era. Part 3. Unrepentant. Did Amnesty, seeing this horrifying mistake, take steps to ensure that in future it would not simply become a source of atrocity propaganda for Western warmongers? Clearly not. Instead, its formal neutrality and its original central purpose are being corrupted by expedience and by the corrosive permeation of the Western discourse of humanitarian intervention. The context is this. Since World War II, the state that has committed the most war crimes is the United States. The state that has committed the most deaths caused the most deaths of innocents, notwithstanding China's great leap forward, is likewise the US. One might use different modes and criteria of calculus, but any consistent and defensible reckoning will return the same answer. When it comes to the use of mass violence, when it comes to the use of deadly ordnance, none can even be considered in the same league as the US. Horrible atrocities such as the Soviet bombing of Herat, the Russian bombing of Grozny, or the Syrian shelling of Hama are as buckets next to the swimming pools of blood from North Korea, South Korea, North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, not to mention dozens of places with lesser body counts, nor indeed all of those other places where similar massacres have been conducted by US clients. Further context. Every large-scale mass atrocity, and the majority of those on a smaller scale, is preceded by atrocity propaganda, wherein the future victim group is portrayed as perpetrators. Sometimes the atrocities are fictitious or massively exaggerated. Sometimes one blames one's own atrocities on an enemy. Sometimes false flag atrocities are actually staged. And sometimes the atrocities are real. The attribution and contextualization, however, are fantastically important. The actual perpetrators, often impossible to distinguish in any event, become of no importance whatsoever. The perpetrators become defined instead by group membership. They become, as Schwarzkopf put it, a bunch. But instead of learning the lesson on 1990, instead of taking steps to avoid becoming a source of atrocity propaganda which facilitates massive suffering and death, Amnesty has more often acted to embrace the very same US imperialist causes which facilitate atrocities. But Amnesty and others, including some alternative news outlets, actively jump at any opportunity to join with the US State Department and the White House in condemnation of human rights abuses. It is as if they wish to ensure that everyone knows that they aren't really anti-American or anti-government. They do have haircuts, they do have jobs. It is as if the tension of having to oppose authority is suddenly released and they can get on with their job of righteous opposition to wrongdoing without fear of being criticized, misapprehended, scorned, or argued with. Like the dissidents who, after years of hopeless opposition to Bush Jr.'s crimes of aggression, so passionately embraced the slogan, "Out of Iraq, into Darfur." They themselves embrace the advocacy and support of war crimes. By not rejecting outright the discourse of humanitarian intervention and of the responsibility to protect doctrine, Amnesty may become a party to war crimes while its history of refusing to determine the legality of military actions as a whole, for example the Iraq invasion or Operation Cast Lead, means that only selected suffering and death is worthy of protest. This is an extremely dangerous mixture. It means that as long as the conduct of the war is in accordance with international humanitarian law, they are not going to comment on any, quote, lawful killings, even in cases of aggression, wherein these so-called lawful killings are actually unlawful murders. They deal with human rights, and apparently there is no right not to be maimed or painfully killed, or to have your family killed or your children killed by a foreign military power. In addition, Amnesty International has of late, like so many others, been embracing what might be described as cronyism. By this term, I mean the enthusiastic and rigid insistence on criminal proceedings being taken against the official villains of the West, who are generally not powerful, often spent forces and no longer a threat, are generally non-Caucasian, and certainly not Westerners, and ipso facto are from the poorer countries in the world. This functions to put a black face in people's minds when thinking of atrocities. The face of savagery, a twisted, uncivilized creature of personal violence and sadism. But the greatest culpable mass murderers sit in offices, no matter what their skin color, and usually don't personally torture, maim, or kill. Amnesty has become a keen proponent of prosecutions in the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, as well as the International Criminal Court. Both the ICTY and the ICTR are seen by critics as overly politicized at the expense of justice. As ad hoc tribunals, they are unavoidably selective, while the ICC seems to be merely avoidably selective, but selective nonetheless. Its indictments are, without exception, against the enemies and defiers of the US, a state which itself refuses to allow its own personnel to be subject to ICC prosecution. By analogy, it is as if the mafia controlled a criminal court, which it used against its own small-time rivals. So, sure, the prosecuted may be guilty of heinous crimes, but there is still a massive injustice in that their very indictment advances the purposes of even greater criminals. Supporters of such courts claim that we cannot allow impunity. Indeed, there are many times when impunity is tantamount to incitement. Some claim that the culture of tit-for-tat atrocities and some civil conflicts stems in part from impunity. So Amnesty International, set up to oppose political imprisonment, is a big proponent of this system, which arguably creates political prisoners, and inarguably creates selective impunity, along with strict and consistent lines of privileging the most powerful state actors and their leaders, who, not coincidentally, are quantifiably the greatest abusers of human rights. But it's actually even worse than that, because the current international justice regime has become a massive impediment to conflict resolution. Evincing at all times self-righteous condemnation for the irredeemable evil malefactors, it is made increasingly clear that to the enemies of the West that they will not escape Western vengeance. What, for example, can Bashar al-Assad glean about Western intentions? Should he look to Saddam Hussein's fate? Or maybe Gaddafi's? In the latter instance, the ICC was so prompt in announcing an intent to prosecute and issuing a warrant that Gaddafi knew from very early in the piece that his fate, at best, would be to end his days in prison. Not a great incentive to find a peaceful solution. What about Charles Taylor? His immunity under peace accords, which had ended conflict and killing, was immediately undermined by the US Congress, who posted a $2 million reward for his capture. These precedents all send a very clear message. Or one could look at Sudan's Omar Hassan al-Bashir, a man who knows that his safety and freedom requires that he cling to power no matter what the cost. Amnesty would claim, no doubt, that its stance stems from principles. They don't change whether the perpetrator state is China or the US, Iran or Israel, Syria or Turkey. Is this true? In reality, they exclude from their remit the most serious crimes committed by the US. Moreover, they clearly have decided, in the cases of Syria or Joseph Kony, for example, to emphasize those instances when they are in accord with Western governments. Without shame, as we've seen, they refer to this as awareness raising, when it is clear that these are the instances of very heightened public awareness in the West. In these instances, groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are massive force multipliers in propaganda wars waged by Western institutions and leaders who might otherwise have very fragile credibility on the subject of human rights and be vulnerable to countercharges. If Amnesty wanted to base itself on principle, it would base itself around opposition to the suffering caused by state violence. In conflict, it can't simply choose only to oppose jus in bello infringements, those relating to the conduct of the war, as if jus ad bellum matters, the legality of the war itself, were of no relevance. Firstly, one cannot simply treat something as presumed legal because one does not wish to determine its legality. Secondly, Amnesty can't ethically justify ignoring suffering simply because it may be legal. Much of their energies are spent opposing the use of the death penalty, which, in most relevant jurisdictions, is completely legal. Consider the implications of Amnesty's stance. Amnesty strongly condemned Israel's use of white phosphorus in Gaza on the grounds that it was indiscriminate and hence illegal. That immediately means that Amnesty's area of concern is not whether Israel inflicted horrible suffering and death, but whether this was lawful. Consider a child. It could be in Fallujah, it could be in Gaza, it could be in the next place, a victim of white phosphorus. White phosphorus wounds and fatalities are particularly horrific in all instances. Fragments of white phosphorus can burn right through flesh and bone. They may continue burning until they are surgically removed. The remnants may still cause problems through toxicity, and the very nature of these burns may cause crippling and agonizing complications that last a lifetime. More horrifying than that, however, is that fine, partially oxidized particles of white phosphorus can form a cloud wherein both oxygen and moisture are depleted, a cloud that is forced downwards by airbursts as practiced in Fallujah and Gaza. We know that in Fallujah this property must have been deliberately exploited because shake-and-bake fire missions were described in a US military journal as being used against positions immune to high explosive artillery. Such a cloud might penetrate, for example, into the shelter of a family. Imagine this hypothetical child, cowering fearfully in a shelter, whose eyes start to burn as the phosphorus particles ignite on the eyeball itself. The child draws breath to scream, and the child is as good as dead because now the particles are in the lungs themselves. Many square meters of surface area are burning, and the child is actually dying from being burnt from the inside out. This is not completely speculative. There are photographs from Fallujah of children who seem to have died in this manner. Amnesty's stance is to oppose the illegal use of white phosphorus. But this death could have resulted from the legal use of white phosphorus. Except, of course, that it is not legal if the war isn't legal, but that's of no concern to Amnesty. So you can see why I believe that the only possible stance of principle is to oppose the suffering caused by state violence. How can anyone say that it's sometimes okay to inflict agonizing death on a child as long as it's lawful? Yes, I do inevitably mean that Amnesty must oppose all war casualties. But remember that under international law, including the UN Charter, war is actually illegal. All casualties of war are crimes, and rightly so, since these are actually human beings, and there is no morally justifiable reason for saying it's okay to kill some of them. Even if they are military personnel, they still feel pain and fear, and their passing still leaves grief. If a party is forced to take the life out of a need for national self-defense, then the aggressor, under the precedent established at Nuremberg, is culpable for the loss of life. So what should Amnesty do? Well, the fact is that there are more limits on doing good than there are on doing harm. On Syria, they need to revert to marshalling intelligence and moral force and eschew alignment with state actors and advocacy of any form of international action based on a UNSC resolution. In general, advocacy of international governmental response should be confined to cases of international aggression. Amnesty should harness citizen activism, not lobby states or international bodies. The whole world should, in addition, move away from the self-righteous demonization of the ICC and strengthen the International Court of Justice or other mechanisms for holding states, not individuals, accountable for putting an end to ongoing crimes such as occupations, blockades, or aggressive sanctions regimes which inflict mass suffering. Part 4. Or are Amnesty really evil lizard psychopaths after all? The vast majority of people are in one of two camps. Either Amnesty is a bunch of misguided, bleeding-heart lefties unintentionally helping the terrorists of this world, or they are unimpeachable fighters for justice, human rights, and dignity. If one reads the Global Research website, however, it is replete with admirable writers and thinkers such as Francis Boyle and Felicity Arbuthnot, for whom Amnesty is more or less the enemy, whether they like it or not. Of course, such critics understand that Amnesty members and activists try to live up to Amnesty's founding principles. But in practical terms, they have to deal with an organization that is far more effective in promoting injustice, indignity, and human suffering. It is probably worth contemplating that this vast disparity between the commonplace perceptions of Amnesty and those of what, in the final analysis, are a small subset of radical dissidents. Nevertheless, it is these few dissidents who tend to have fact and logic on their side. In the final analysis, Amnesty might as well be run by the evil alien lizards, and I think the explanation for the state of affairs lies in the nature of liberalism. John Pilger recently described liberalism as the world's most powerful and violent ism in an article linking liberal ideology to imperial state policies. At a later date, I will doubtless be detailing all the evils that can be ascribed to liberalism. Always a fun topic. But here I will confine myself to saying that any ideology which claims to have tenets which are good in moral terms, and by extension whose adherents are good as adherents, and inescapably better morally than non-adherents, any such ideology is prone to violent hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance. A liberal can enthusiastically endorse condemnations of liberal atrocities, for example, because those atrocities aren't really liberal, because liberal means good. You could ascribe the same behavior to a communist, a Muslim, or a Christian. The more predominant and self-satisfied an ideology is, the more violent and schizophrenic it becomes. There are two differences between liberalism and other such ideologies. The first is that liberalism has made a quantum leap in its ability to subsume and subvert its own critics and their condemnations. And the second is that liberal schizophrenia is being deliberately harnessed by the most massive imperial military in human history. Imagine liberal interventionism as being a call to enforce liberal political and economic governance within which is a bundle. The liberal bundle includes humanitarian aspects, or at least it seems to. Take women's rights. Liberals believe that imposing liberal governance and norms improves women's rights. If women actually suffer under the imposition of liberalism, then things aren't liberal enough. Either that, or the liberal will trot out racist or crypto-racist rationalizations which either blame the victim directly or blame their often equally suffering male compatriots. In the final analysis, the imposition of liberal governance has not, in fact, been a great boon for women and girls in places such as Southeast Asia and Latin America. In fact, compared with the advances for women's rights under socialist regimes of various types, liberal feminism has, in fact, been beyond pathetic. Even in the West, women's rights, for which liberals claim credit, have mostly come through grassroots left-wing agitation, like many other progressive changes. So the liberal bundle is really kind of agnostic when it comes to humanitarian matters. Their ideology says that they have the cure, but they don't actually care if the cure works. Likewise, the economic aspects of the bundle are supposed to do all sorts of wonderful things. But they don't, and when liberals bother to concern themselves with that inconvenient fact, they tend to say that more drastic liberalisation is the answer. Now, liberal interventionism is now often expressed as being humanitarian interventionism. This is one of several newspeak terms which attend the liberal interventionist discourse. Intervention being understood to be military in nature, it means that causing destruction and death is humanitarian. Here is where the creepy post-Orwellian brilliance of it comes through. Out of two sets of strident fanatics for explicitly liberal intervention in the US, one bunch deliberately positions itself as being right-wing and calls itself neoconservative, and another lot characterizes itself as being left-wing and calls itself liberal. They use exactly the same tropes, evince exactly the same motives, and call for exactly the same interventions. The only significant difference is one which I'll get to shortly. Perhaps the epitome of the latter variety, the liberals, is Samantha Power, the very image of a bleeding heart who wants to drop humanitarian bombs. Journalist David Reif tells of her response to a suggestion that, quote, her reasoning on foreign policy was similar to that of the neoconservatives who supported the Iraq War. She said jokingly, quote, I'm not Paul Wolfowitz. And I said, yeah, actually, I think you are, end quote. Power, along with Clinton and Obama, thrives on taking the moral high ground and harnessing opposition to liberal imperialism, to the very liberal imperialism of the neocons and others who identify themselves as more right-wing and may or may not take more socially and culturally conservative positions. Then they take the very energy of outrage at this form of US imperialism and channel it into support for US imperialism. There is another of that ilk named Suzanne Nossel, a former State Department employee who, quote, would have worked for and with Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Samantha Power, and Susan Rice, and undoubtedly helped them successfully implement their R2P, otherwise known as humanitarian intervention, as well as the newly created Atrocity Prevention Board. She also credits herself with having come up with the term smart power, which is so often now on Clinton's lips. I won't go into the complicated process of paring away the meaningless rhetoric around the term smart power. What it means, put simply, is exactly the same liberal imperialism pursued by Bush and his neocon allies, dressed up a bit differently. One can already detect that a key differentiation is in the way these costumes are gendered. Smart power is sly and feminine, whereas Bush-era cowboy style is masculine and muscular. Thus, one could summarize the Obama versus Romney foreign policy debate in two short lines, saving us a great deal of time. Romney calls Obama a wimp. Obama calls Romney an idiot. Then we all go home. Smart power is all just making a virtue of necessity. Bush-era unilateralism isn't practicable, nor realistically desirable for current imperial geostrategic wants. If, for example, they wish to repeat their actions against Iraq on Iran, they would be looking at a decade or so of genocidal sanctions that isolate the Iranian people and increase an inescapable dependency on their increasingly oppressive regime. Only then, when international public revulsion and regional disobedience among client states threaten to destroy the genocide regime, would it be desirable to unleash the gung-ho bulldozer of a Bush neocon-style war machine? So that's what Suzanne Nossel's about. And guess what her job is now? That's right, she's CEO of Amnesty International USA. That's why people are referring to Amnesty as a shill of the State Department, or the propaganda arm of NATO, or as an imperialist tool. Consternation has been particularly fueled by Amnesty USA's crucial support for NATO's ongoing occupation of Afghanistan. In an excellent article, Anne Wright and Colleen Rowley write of, quote, announcements posted online as well as billboard announcements on Chicago bus stops saying, quote, NATO keep the progress growing, going, sorry, end quote. These beckoned us to find out more on Sunday, May the 20th, 2012, the day thousands of activists marched in Chicago in protest of NATO's wars. Another article is worth quoting at length, where it takes up exactly the same story of what Amnesty was doing on the very day that people were mobilizing to oppose war in Chicago. Amnesty USA put on a shadow summit of its own during the NATO meeting, featuring Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton's notorious Secretary of State, who will be forever remembered for her chilling response to a question on 60 Minutes about sanctions imposed on Iraq in the 1990s. Correspondent Leslie Stahl asked, quote, "We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it?" End quote. Albright responded, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." End quote. With a veritable war criminal as one of its star speakers, Amnesty USA Shadow Summit launched a campaign that, for all intents and purposes, called for an extension of NATO's good works in Afghanistan. Its speakers and promotional materials recycled George Bush's feminist justification of the invasion and occupation, that NATO would liberate women from Taliban rule. The article then examines the reality of women's lives in occupied Afghanistan, finding the claims of progress to be laughable. Quote, "As Sonali Kolakta, founder of the Afghan Women's Mission, and Miriam Rawi of the Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan wrote, under the Taliban, women are confined to their homes. They were not allowed to work or attend school. They were poor and without rights. They had no access to clean water or medical care, and they were forced into marriages, often as children. Today, women in the vast majority of Afghanistan live in precisely the same conditions, with one notable difference. They are surrounded by war." End quote. Part 5. Conclusions. Number 1. Yes to mass murdering sociopaths. People like Nossals are mass murderers. Okay, she may not be a sociopath, but then again she might be. We don't know, and why would we care? Some mass murderers believe deeply that they will make the world a better place. Others are driven by hatred, fear, or insanity, and others still are monstrously callous and simply don't care for the suffering they cause. In this, I agree with the biblical sentiments. Know people from their actions, but leave judging to some hypothesized supernatural omniscient being, because we aren't in the position to judge. Number 2. Yes to toadies enabling mass murder. Amnesty members want to do good, but self-satisfaction is unreflexive and causes complacency. Amnesty members need to discriminate more in terms of what they support and what they don't. It might sound complicated, but it isn't. When Amnesty is calling for a petition writing and pressure to be put on a government which is committing abuses, it's all good. When they are calling for petitions and pressure to be put on a government to intervene in another state, it's not good at all. It's the opposite of good, which some of us like to call bad. Number 3. Yes to compassionate voice for good. Of course, most Amnesty members, volunteers, and staff are fundamentally committed to alleviating human suffering. Perhaps it should be no surprise, then, that there is a movement to reform Amnesty International from within. Staff and members have expressed disquiet, and there is also a Code Pink petition campaign. I would argue that reform of Amnesty is worth pursuing. It might be too much to expect deep, principled reform, but even at worst, a curtailing of pro-imperialist efforts in order to regain lost credibility and avoid crucial scrutiny deprives the empire of a very significant tool, albeit temporarily. A more confrontational approach, aiming to publicize Amnesty's true nature and reveal it for what it effectively is, might seem attractive and understandable, but most people are never really going to understand the premise that this renowned humanitarian organization is engaged in warmongering. That makes Amnesty and such like a bit of a tar baby, which is also quite handy for the US Empire as a form of distraction. If you want to attack something, just attack the policies and the false justifications behind them. People will work out for themselves that Amnesty is behaving inappropriately from that context. I would like to thank you for listening to this commentary. A transcript, complete with photographs, hyperlinks, and even a few good old-fashioned endnote citations, is available at the On Genocide blog, which is at ongenocide.wordpress.com. There is also a Facebook page called On Genocide, in case you didn't guess. If you like the Facebook page, I promise to post no more than 2 or 3 items a day, including, of course, updates to the blog. My name is Kieran Kelly, and you've been listening to an On Genocide audio commentary, and I'm going to leave you with Phil Oakes doing a bit of liberal bashing.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies, and I put down the old D.A.R. D.A.R., that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen, my faith in the system restored, and I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter, don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bus my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation. I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for. But don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal.